I don't know what to say, so I'm just going to say it anyway. It's the news, according to me. Yeah. It is Friday. Financial Friday. Here we go. Yeah, here we go. It's Friday, March 20th. 8:16 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. I am your host, I guess. I don't know what I am. I'm here talking to the microphone here. Thing. You may be out there working hard, hardly working, whatever you're doing. Or you might just be sitting around trying to recoup from some kind of shoulder injury or something. I don't know. Just a thought. Tell me I don't know my audience. I know my audience like the back of my hand, the side of their shoulder. I hope that all goes well. I hope that's, pray for healing on that. We have lots of things going on. Occasionally I throw comments out there, kind of inside jokes, whatever they are. They're inside information, I should say. It wasn't a joke. It's interesting. I get text messages, emails, and stuff from people that I consider family more than anything. My voice is weird today. I don't know what's going on with that. I've got about a half a cup left. I've already drank it. I wasn't really doing show prep this morning. I was just kind of screwing around. I did do a little bit. I've got this thing. Today's Financial Friday, of course, and we're going to get into that in just a little bit after a little interlude. We have this interlude thing now. We do. It's kind of fun. It gives me a chance to, it gives you a chance to heat up your coffee, whatever you're doing. It's all about you. It's not about me, but it's all about it's all about you listening to me. I want you sharp and paying attention. So I give you a little break so you can refocus, get that brain, kind of elasticized again, get some wrinkles put in there. We got a lot of things going on. A lot of stuff happening in the world. However, I think James Comey's back in the news. We're not going to talk about it, but I am talking about it. We have he kind of dropped off the map there for a while after his little. He was doing some stuff with. He's got this weird channel thing. He's trying to be like. He's like a kid. I don't understand. He does this little TikTok thing or something, I guess. Who does that? How many former directors of the FBI have we had doing that kind of thing? Where he's trying to be like pop culture relatable. It's weird. The guy's a freak. I did that whole thing 86-47 or whatever it was. I didn't know what that meant. I didn't have any idea. Yeah, I just thought it seemed like an interesting thing that somebody put down in the beach there. I just took a picture of it, put it on TikTok. Yeah, I do that all the time. Whenever I see something weird like that, I take pictures of it, put it on there. I had no idea what it meant. If I don't know what it means, I'm not going to put it on social media if I don't know what it means. That's for sure. He's a freak. The guy's a freak. Anyway, I could go on about that. But anyway, apparently there's a conspiracy issue. Now, this Pam Bondi screwed it up the first time they tried to go after him. And maybe I don't think she intentionally tried to screw it up. But maybe it was best that it was screwed up. This has been kind of the typical way this, it's probably best that Trump didn't win in 2020. Well, it's best that he didn't get in office in 2020. Put it that way. Because now he'd be gone. He'd be gone now. They wouldn't have to deal with him anymore. He'd be done. His second term would be over. He'd be on to the next thing. And it would be, but now they have to deal with him instead of dealing with him for 8 years, they're dealing with him for 12. People make really irrational, stupid decisions. One of the things I think they're doing right now, they're trying to convince you that the gas prices need to spike. Every expert that you hear talk about this thing in terms of finances is that there's plenty of oil. Right now, the world is in a wash with oil. There's a huge amount of production that's been taking place. The refineries are going to slow down at some point. That, which has nothing to do really with our economy here. It really shouldn't even. The global economy, all oil is tied to the global economy. So all energy prices are, you know, it's all globally traded. It's not, we don't just keep our own oil here. But it is, it does affect our price, but not to the, to the extent that it's going, you know, $1 more a gallon than it was, you know, 2 weeks ago. It's just, it's ridiculous. And so it's this fear mongering, it's speculation, it's all this stuff that's going on right now with the whole market, and what's funny about this is it's just like Trump. It just cracks me up the way he does this. He goes in, you know, of course they were protecting the straits that the Iranians were trying to close off and trying to make it so that they couldn't get people, ships couldn't get through there. And, you know, he asked the French, "Hey, step up. Let's you know, come over and help. You know, how about the, Europe, or, you know, all the European Union folks, you know, London. How about England and some of these other countries over there? Why don't you come on over and help us out with this, keeping this strait open?" "No, we're not going to do that. No, we are not going to do that. We're not going to participate in this." "Oh, okay. Well, then we'll just leave it alone then." "Oh, wait a minute. That's where our oil comes from. We can't do that. What? Well, maybe we should be, maybe we should help you with that." That's what's happened here. He basically just called their bluff and said, "Okay, then we're just going to leave that area alone. Then we're just going to let them do whatever they want to over there. We're not going to keep it open for you." Well, of course, their whole explanation is, "Well, you started this war." No, they started the war. This is something you have to understand. The history of everything that's going on here, and people, I wish I could call Elena on here because she's the historian. If you really look into the whole thing that's going on there with Iran, and you totally understand their history, and what has happened with the mullahs and all the Islamic State stuff that's happened there, if you dig really deep into the actual history of what's happened there, not just what media is telling you it's going on or what academia seems to be, it's just like their history about Gaza and everything else. It is so skewed and so messed up in what they're telling the American people. It is a surface mentality feeling kind of thing that you're getting from most of them. And it's a messed up balance of power thing over there. Now, I'm not saying we should necessarily get involved in it. It's just I'm just tired of all the disinformation or misinformation, whatever you want to call it. I think it's disinformation, in my opinion. I think it's deliberate. As to what has happened there, what's going on over there, and I think that the whole motivation for what Trump is doing there is I understand it. I'm not sure. I'm not going to say I agree with it. I'm just saying I understand it. But I do know in many of the interviews that I've watched with that have people involved in Iran and the Persians, the people who consider them Persians, themselves Persian, they're happy about this. The vast majority of them are glad this has happened. Now, every Democrat, just Fetterman came out and said recently, every Democrat that's ran for office in the last 20, 30 years has always talked about Iran and how they, you know, all this stuff about Iran, how they've got to be stopped. And now a president finally steps up and stops it. And they're, you know, being critical about it. And it just, now Fetterman's not, he's still on the left, folks. He's still a leftist. But he's not a leftist. He's not a left-wing lunatic. I wouldn't even call him a traditional Democrat. I would say he's still left of that. But he's a reasonable Democrat. He at least he can acknowledge, hey, when you do something good, we need to acknowledge that they've done something good. Not just this Trump derangement syndrome. He said somebody asked him who the leader of the Democrat Party is right now. He said, well, Trump derangement syndrome runs the party right now. This guy's got more. Yeah, duh. That's kind of an obvious one, I guess, isn't it? I don't think this thing actually did anything, did it? I think I need to do this again because there's something wrong with that. I'm just going to do that because that's that. There we go. I can replace that. Okay, there we go. File, project. Replace it. Yes. There we go. Okay, bounce it. There we go. Wait a minute. What was that other question it asked me? I don't know. We might have to do that again. Anyway, I've got other things going on in the background. I got a life besides the show. Stuff going on. Anyway, all that stuff's going on. And I'm just saying. Let's just move on. This is not what the show's supposed to be about today, and I'm spending too much time on it. We got my cup here. It's got chai with Almond Joy creamer, and I got it right the first time that time. In my backup cup, I made a fresh batch. I'm only going to be gone for a couple days, so I made a fresh batch of sweet peach tea. I'm leaving today, back on Sunday. That's the plan anyway. So I will be back for Monday morning's show. At least that's the plan. If I get stuck in Dallas Sunday night, that's the only possibility, I guess. I don't know the weather's supposed to be doing the next couple of days. I should probably look at that just in case. Because that can always happen. Anyway, so that's what we got going on. I have, what is that? Oh, well, here. But no, that's, where did it go? Oh, there it is. No, that's not it either. I don't know where it went. Anyway, I'll be right back. Dum, 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 dum,
dum, dum, dum. It's the news. It's the news. According to me, oh, it's the news. According to me, it's the news.
It's the news.
According to me, oh, it's the news.
It's the news.
It's the news.
It's the news, yeah.
According to me, it's the news.
It's the news.
According to me, it's the news. According to me.
It is the news, according to me. I'm sorry, I had the mute button on. I started talking there, and it was obviously doesn't work at that point. We have, what do we get? I'm still working on this other thing because it just continues on forever. Yeah, that's not there. I was going to say, that's not there. Oh, that's great. All right, well, what I'm going to do is I'm going to do that. We're just going to redo this thing. There we go. All right, we got it right there. Okay, I got it. I'm going to do it this time. Boom, there we go. There we go. Now we got it. It's happening. I don't know where it went the last time. It went somewhere. Sometimes I'll save a file, and it goes. I don't know where it goes. It disappeared. So I'll probably find a file in my drive sometime, at some point that's full of stuff. That's where all that stuff went. Financial Friday. We have a... I've got some interesting things here. There's something called Notebook LM. And I produced this is interesting. There's this guy called Nick Invests. Now, I'm doing this as an example today of what AI can do for you. And sometimes how stupid it is. But it is, what is that? Interactive mode. Well, there's an interactive mode. Well, let's just go to that. This is a video, which I think is kind of like a podcast. So this is going to be a podcast within a podcast. You have to make sure you don't really take this away, so I can say it the way Tim Waltz says stuff. Because it makes it a bit more serious. National Guard troops have been deployed. Take away your pop filter to do that. There's this guy, there's this channel called Nick Invests, and I haven't talked about it for a while. What do I have to do here? Push play? Play audio. This is called interactive mode. Theoretically, you can, as you're listening to this thing, you can actually, I have no idea what this is going to do. All I did was put the last six videos of Nick Invests. I put it in there. And what they do is they come up with this this podcast. I don't know. It forms this for you within Nick. This is in within Notebook. Notebook LM will only give you data from whatever you put in the notebook. So I put a bunch of links to all these videos in there. It summarizes from the transcripts from all these videos. It doesn't actually watch the video or watch anything. It just summarizes all the content. And then I've got, I don't know what I've got here. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. 6 videos in there. And I think every time you click on it, it will give you a different synopsis of the video. So it'll form different context each time, because of course each video has its own context, so it'll kind of formulate around one particular subject. This one says why high earners stay broke, and this is, I think that is actually one of the, is it one of his titles? I don't know if it is. Minimalist. This is why compounding is why $300,000 net worth feels like nothing today. Whatever that is. It's interesting how they pull this together, but we're going to play this. It's the first time I've heard it. I just put it all in there, and we're going to generate it, and now we're going to listen to it together. That's where we're at with this technology. We're just going to experience it together as we go. So see how this happens.
You know, it is funny. You are earning more right now than you ever have in your entire life.
Here we go.
I mean, if you look at your current salary, it was probably a number that would have absolutely thrilled your younger self a decade ago.
Oh, absolutely. It is wild to think about.
Right, but then somehow you check your bank account at the end of the month, and you still feel like you are exactly one broken transmission away from a total financial crisis.
Yeah, okay. That is a very
okay. Now these two are talking to each other, and it's this AI bounce back forth thing. They're having this little discussion. It's fascinating because there's a little thing down here I can click on and I can ask it a question. We're going to do that in a little bit. Let's go ahead and let them continue to talk. And see where this goes.
Common reality.
You have the income, the title, the outward signs of success, but the underlying security just is not there. Why does that happen?
Well, it is a completely disorienting feeling for a lot of people. I mean, we are culturally conditioned from childhood to believe that income equals wealth. But the underlying mathematics of personal finance, they tell a totally different story.
And that disconnect is the core of what we're getting into today. We are pulling from a really fascinating stack of transcripts from a financial analyst known as Nick Invests.
It is some really eye-opening material.
It really is. The mission of our deep dive today is to decode the incredibly unglamorous hidden math of wealth building. And we are going to reveal why a high salary is absolutely not the vehicle that gets you to financial freedom. Okay, let's unpack this.
So to set the stage, the sources contrast two real financial profiles that perfectly illustrate this paradox. First, we have Crippus. He makes $155,000 a year.
Okay, that is a great salary.
Right. And he lives in a nice apartment, drives the leased BMW, always has the newest technology. But behind the scenes, Marcus has $4,800 in hidden credit card debt that he carries month to month.
Yikes.
Yeah, and his financial runway, which is the exact amount of time he could...
Wait, an 11...
Okay. Now, I understand living in a big city, expensive city. I understand how you get into this trap. It's very easy to do because you just think the money's always going to be there. You're constantly making this amount of money. You're constantly spending. You have all this stuff. You can just buy whatever you want. Get into this habit of just being able to buy whatever you want, whenever you want. I get it. I understand that. But there's also this understanding that, hey, this well is finite. It may not always be there, and you better be stacking some money away. At that kind of a wage, well, first of all, the car is too much. And of course, the latest technology, always having to have the latest and greatest. That gets expensive. That's just a keeping up with the whoever is next door. Probably not Jones's anymore. But that's what's happening there. Well, let's continue on.
7-day runway on $155,000 salary. Like, the mathematical margin for error there isn't just thin. It effectively does not exist.
Exactly. And then you contrast his situation with Dana. So Dana makes $72,000 a year.
Less than half of what Marcus makes.
Right. But she drives a paid-off 2019 Honda Civic. She keeps her phone until the battery physically will not hold a charge. And she has a net worth of $167,000.
Wow. Good for her.
And her financial runway is 6 full months, so Marcus earns more than double Dana's salary, but Dana has accumulated more than 14 times his net worth.
That is just staggering. We really have to start by dismantling this fundamental myth that making more money magically solves money problems. I mean, the data
Exactly.
clearly shows.
Here is the psychological mechanism at play, which behavioral economists call hedonic adaptation or lifestyle creep. When your income goes up, your brain almost immediately normalizes that new baseline. The luxuries of last year become the absolute necessities of today. The sources actually cite Bloomberg data showing that roughly one-third of households earning over $250,000 a year report living paycheck to paycheck.
This is true. And it's a very seductive thing that happens to us psychologically, what ends up happening here. And I don't know how to explain it. It is a like you said, it is this thing where the luxuries of yesterday become the necessities of today. It is a very, it is lifestyle creep, and it really is. It's like the old frog in the water thing, which I don't know if that's really true or not, but it's this whole thing. And it's now, I'm going to let them continue to talk here. I think this only goes on for like 5 minutes, 4 or 5 minutes, but we'll continue on with this thing.
A quarter of a million dollars, and they're still sweating the electric bill. That is crazy.
Because without a conscious, deliberate intervention, every single raise gets completely absorbed by your lifestyle before it can actually hit your balance sheet and build wealth.
So what is the intervention?
The intervention the sources recommend is defining your enough number. This requires calculating exactly what you need to be comfortable. So your absolute floor for rent, food, healthcare, transportation,
Okay.
then adding 20% for breathing room and things you genuinely enjoy, and actually writing that specific number down. Any raise or bonus you get past that baseline goes strictly toward wealth creation, not lifestyle inflation.
The danger of not defining that number brings up the Diderot effect mentioned in the sources, named after the 1769 French philosopher, Denis Diderot.
Oh, yes, this is a
Oh, now
great
we have a
story.
story
Right, so
anymore.
he was gifted this beautiful, expensive scarlet dressing gown. But once he put it on in his study, he noticed his old desk chair looked incredibly cheap by comparison.
Yeah,
Of
this is how
course
it
it
happens.
did.
Yeah, so he replaced the chair. Then the writing table looked wrong, so he replaced that. Eventually, he replaced his entire study just to match the elevated standard of the gown, plunging himself into massive debt.
That cascading chain of consumption is exactly how a raise vanishes. I mean, if
it
you
is.
don't define your enough, your spending will define it for you, and it will always define it as slightly more than you currently make.
I have to challenge this slightly, though. Doesn't income matter at all? I mean, the way we talk about lifestyle creep, it feels like software bloat on a smartphone.
How do you mean?
Well, you buy a new phone with a processor that is twice as fast, but the new operating system and all the background apps demand three times the power, so your battery still dies by noon. I understand the Diderot effect, but surely grabbing a bigger salary, like a faster processor, helps outpace the bloat.
It only helps if you actively restrict those background apps from running. The gap between Marcus and Dana isn't their income. It is that Dana defined her enough, and Marcus let his spending cascade out of control.
Right, you let all the apps run at once.
Exactly. Without that written enough number anchoring your behavior, the Diderot effect will consume every extra dollar you bring in, no matter how powerful your income processor gets.
Now, I want to just say here, this is one of the things that Dave Ramsey gets on the nose. One of the things I think that helps it helps to understand this kind of creep is having at least a mindful budget. Now, but it takes even more than that to some extent. So I'll dive into this a little bit. And I'm not a financial counselor. I'm not a doctor. I'm not a lawyer. I'm not a geopolitical expert. I'm not a military expert. I'm just a guy with a microphone. This is all for entertainment purposes only. But I'm just kind of demonstrating what this thing will do, and I'm going to comment on it. And at some point, I'm going to jump in here and ask him a question. But the interesting thing here is that there needs to be a deliberate. One of the things that will give you financial peace, and I think that's what Dave Ramsey calls his thing, is Financial Peace University or whatever he calls it. But it is true. There's this anxiety that forms around things. Now, giving, for instance, I've got this, a certain percentage of my everything that comes in. So anytime there's any money coming in, any kind of income, certain kinds of income, I should say. There's some income that I don't do this with, but that goes into a separate account. But there's any kind of money that comes in is divided up immediately into different boxes, basically, or what I think Ramsey used to call it. He just had the envelope system, or he'd put a certain amount of money, a certain percentage of your funds into certain things. And it's I don't know about this. I'm not sure that this is a case or not, but it almost seems like it's a spiritual principle. And it seems almost as if God has a certain way of blessing you through this process. And I don't understand it at all. Maybe it's not the case. Maybe it's just kind of a coincidence thing. But I'm not saying I totally understand how. Now, for one thing, financial income is not necessarily. I know people who've been given. They found a $20 bill. It was such a blessing. It's like, thank you, God. Okay, well, yeah, that's sometimes you need to recognize that just finances are not always a blessing. I know plenty of people who are ungodly who have plenty of money. They make money, they find money. It's not, you know, of course, God has gifted them with whatever, but they're, you know, abusing that gift or doing whatever. Just the intricacies there are go well beyond our ability to just have a little understanding of that. And sometimes I've known people. Let's just put it this way: I've known Christians who seem to think that anytime money comes into their life, that's God's blessing. It's almost as if that's God's approval of them. And no, that's not the case. Unless money is your God, I guess it almost becomes that point. It's as if the only way God blesses you is through finances. It just seems that if they have money, that's God's blessing. If they lose money, that's God's curse. I'm not sure I ascribe to that. I'm sure I don't ascribe to that. But anyway, the whole thing when you start to recognize money as a tool and something that is there for, you know, it's not yours. You were born without any of it, and you're going to die without any of it. It's one of those things where you can't take it with you, kind of stuff, kind of thing. You didn't bring it in, you're not going to take it out. Of course, this gets into the whole. Anyway, back up here. This idea of percentages and the things that are available, there's no stress in it. When you stack money aside for giving, for instance, and then when something comes up that you feel like you're supposed to, that you believe you're supposed to give to, or that you want to give to, or that you have the ability to give to, it's there already. You've already given it. It's not in your hands. It's not something that's coming out of your account that you had set up for. I was going to buy this tool, but now I can't because I got to give this. I got to give this one. That's not what happens. I've already given it. I'm not even looking at it. That's all money that's sitting there, waiting for opportunity, and I look for opportunity. It's not just. I'm looking for reasons to get that account down. And the reasons they pop up quite often, and it's kind of amazing to me sometimes how people react to that. People that I know have means, people that I know that have made money, the people that's they're shocked at how, well, you're so generous. No, you're not. I'm not. They're saying that about me. I'm not saying anybody's ever said that about me. It's probably not. But it's one of those things where. It's a no brainer at that point. It is. You obviously have to be responsible with it. But it's already done. It's the giving has already happened. It just hasn't been dispersed yet. So that's the same thing happens with your bills. If you put away, say you've got certain bills you got to pay. It's just certain things you got to pay. You got to pay whatever it is, your mortgage, or you got to pay your rent, or whatever it is. You got to pay your. Now, of course, if you're living beyond your means, in a house that's too big, or an apartment that's too expensive, or whatever it is, or you've got too fancy of a car. Well, I've got to pay my car payment. Yeah, well, you didn't have to buy a Mercedes. Maybe you didn't have to buy that car. Or maybe you bought a 1976 Mercedes. What was it? The SL, the old S. You can get them for like $4,000 or $5,000, and they're incredibly dependable. They'll keep on running forever. I mean, if you bought that kind of a car, that's one thing. Because they're all electromechanical. You can fix everything on them. It's an amazing car. There's cars like that out there. Okay, so if you're buying something like that, it's a Mercedes, whatever. If you're just going out buying a posh new, you know, Lambo or whatever you're buying with your money, that's just stupid. Now you can buy a money pit. We've got a particular Volvo. I've had very good success with Volvos, and it's not that they're necessarily I would say they're more dependable maybe than other. They're not necessarily more dependable. To some degree they are. We put a lot of miles on our cars. A lot. I've got over 330,000 miles on my Volvo. Every Volvo we have now has over 200,000 miles on it. We have three of them. We've owned five total. All of them have had, two of them have taken over 300,000 miles. That's when they got into a crash. But the, and the crash, there were no injuries. As far as us, the cars were totaled because they were so old. The insurance company totaled them. But the point here is, and there's a point there somewhere. It's probably on my head. You get something that's living within your means and that works for your life that you have to have to go to work, to earn your money, whatever you got to do. You got to be able to drive back and forth to work or whatever you got going on, you take the bus or whatever you're going to do. All those things are budgeted in. Now it's all the extra spending. Now, if you take a percentage of your income, say you set aside 5% of your income for just crazy spending, just whatever you want to spend it on, movies, popcorn, snacks, whatever. Just extracurricular stuff. Not even considering, not even calling it eating out. Maybe you've got another account that you put into there, so you can go out to dinner. It's just your dinner account, which you can. And there's you get your grocery account, so you got food. Maybe you've got a little account that you put money into to buy, apocalypse food like the dried freeze dried stuff. And you got money you set aside for. What you call your emergency fund. And it's good to set aside a little bit. You know, maybe you've got an emergency fund that'll take you through 6 months or a year, whatever you've got, or a month even, just whatever you got that you got set aside. It doesn't hurt to keep adding to that. Maybe you're going to put, even just 2% of your income. Just once you got that where you want it to be, maybe it's your six month emergency fund that you can live on for 6 months. So you get that set aside. You get that in a little account that you can draw from. Maybe it's drawing interest, maybe it's not, but it's sitting there and you just put a little bit into there, just something, even just $100 a month or something, or $50 a month, whatever it is, because I guarantee you that you won't be sorry about that. You're going to be happy about that because, inflation makes that go down every day. And when the poop does hit the fan, that's a mess. It makes a mess. When the things do kind of get wrapped around the axle, as they say, I guarantee you things are going to cost more. They're going to cost more. And just like the price of gas going up right away. Well, that's that emergency fund that could have carried you through a normal personal emergency will not carry you through a national emergency because food's going to go up. Gas is going to go up. Everything's going to go up. It's going to cost more. So just keep stacking that up a little bit there. That's my personal advice. I'm not a financial counselor. You do you. You need to do, But it's just one of those things where you don't do stupid things with your livelihood. Now, I understand you got kids, you got family, you got other issues you have to take care of. Maybe you got medical bills, whatever, school loans, all those kinds of things. You got to get those dealt with, get them taken care of. Get out of debt. First of all, let me just say this. This is my personal advice. That's my professional advice based on long-time living, not based on any kind of education or any kind of certificates that I have. Stay out of debt as much as possible. Now, medical bills can really throw a wrench in that. if you happen to have a medical problem, now we're talking. things beyond your control, and sometimes they are within your control. It's just something, medical problems that you've caused yourself, whatever. But there are things out there that happen to people, and it's I get that. It can eat your finances away real quick, real fast. Everything's gone. So that there again, having a little bit of foresight, getting some things set up like a trust, or getting some things set up like a, or whatever, however you got things set up with your legal status and you know where your money is. That's important as well. It's difficult. It's a difficult process, and I think that again, professional help. Even you know, maybe you can't afford a lawyer. I gotta say, don't just go by ChatGPT and what ChatGPT says. What I'm saying is, talk to AI about it. But at the same time, maybe not necessarily just one LLM. Maybe talk to several. Go to Grok, go to ChatGPT, and just type in the same prompt and just ask him questions about the same thing, or ask it to come up with a prompt. Say, this is my situation. How should I best handle this? And what's the best financial advice for this? And of course, it's going to give you all kinds of disclaimers as well. But it's going at least you got some other ideas. You got some other things. And pop all your stuff into something like this notebook LM thing and have it give you a podcast. And you can sit here and listen to it like this.
Okay, so if a higher income isn't saving us, we need to look at where those dollars are actually leaking out. The sources point out that our accounts are being drained by the invisible price tags of everyday choices. Basically, every single purchase carries a second price tag.
This is a brutal piece of math, but it is essential for changing behavioral patterns. We all understand the concept of opportunity costs when we are looking at something massive, like, you know, a mortgage interest rate.
Right.
But our brains fail to apply it to microtransactions. The second price tag is what your money would have become if it had been invested instead of spent.
Can you give an example from the text?
Yeah. For example, you justify a $300 a month car payment upgrade because you spent a lot of time commuting. But if you calculate the compounding interest over 25 years, that $300 a month upgrade is actually a $243,000 loss to your future net worth.
Wow. And the takeout habit is another massive one. The sources show that spending $50 on DoorDash every few days becomes a $700,000 loss over 30 years.
It is wild.
$700,000 for the privilege of not cooking dinner on a random Tuesday.
It really forces you to look at the mechanics of your spending. Another analytical tool the sources provide is converting money into hours of life.
Oh, I love this part.
Yeah, you calculate this by taking your monthly take-home pay and dividing it by 160, which is the average number of working hours in a month.
Okay, so you find your true hourly rate.
Right. If that math comes out to $25 an hour and you want to buy a $700 phone upgrade, you aren't just swiping a piece of plastic. You are physically trading 28 hours of your finite, irreplaceable life for a device that will be obsolete in 3 years.
I get the math. I really do. But practically speaking, human beings run on dopamine. If I have to calculate the 30-year opportunity cost of a side of guacamole, I am going to suffer severe decision fatigue.
That is a fair point.
Right. Like, if I scrutinize every single dollar, doesn't this make every purchase feel like a terrible decision? How do we actually...
Oh, hey, I think our listeners got something to say.
That's me coming in here. Hey, yeah, good morning. I have a question for you. One of the things is the discipline of spending... Wait a minute. This... wants to use my microphone. Hold on a second. Allow all of this. Okay. Hello. I have a question for you. It has to do with fiscal discipline. I guess the discipline.
Welcome in. This is exactly what we wanted you to do.
Hello. That is a great interjection.
You are bringing up the fundamental tension.
I think
here,
it went without
between the math and the.
I didn't get my
right,
point.
If you calculate the opportunity cost of every single dollar, you would never spend anything.
And that would lead to deprivation and misery. And that is not the goal here.
The whole objective is not restriction or guilt. It is intention.
Oh,
let's hear it.
Okay, yeah, here we go again. The question is the issue of discipline, I guess, in terms of fiscal responsibility and being able to set aside money for things ahead of time so that you have that in any budgeted item ahead of time, like as a percentage of your income.
Issue of discipline. That is the million-dollar question
just,
right
just
there.
Took off without
you have hit on the core conflict of the entire topic.
I'm supposed
we were
to hold the button
to
down.
About this very thing.
Most people assume that building wealth requires heroic, sustained discipline.
Like you have to be a monk resisting every single impulse purchase.
But the sources actually argue the complete opposite.
They say that willpower is not a financial strategy.
There we go.
And
so I kind of changed the course of their conversation, I believe.
Which is comforting.
Here is where it gets really interesting. The wealthiest people aren't more disciplined than the average person.
They just built better architecture that removes the need for constant, painful discipline.
They use something called automate the override.
It means you make saving the default, not a decision you have to fight for every month.
Think about the difference between voluntary 401k enrollment and auto enrollment.
When saving is a decision, you ask your brain to choose between the real, right now, and the abstract, 30 years away.
And the future almost always loses that fight.
But when you automate transfers on payday, the money moves before you ever see it.
Your brain never has to fight the urge to keep it.
That removes the need for discipline entirely, which is the genius of this approach.
So instead of relying on willpower, you build system.
It is about removing the psychological friction from good behavior.
And adding friction to bad behavior, like impulse spending.
That is exactly where the identity audit and the 72-hour firewall come in.
We were just asking, how do we actually sustain this over decades without feeling crushing guilt about simply buying a burrito?
The sources address this by suggesting we need to target specific behaviors rather than every purchase.
This is where we talk about the identity audit.
Yeah, that's one of the best tools for intentionality, not restriction.
You need to ask yourself who you're actually buying things for.
It is all about checking the motivation behind the purchase.
Exactly.
My belly.
Are you buying that luxury car or that expensive dinner because it genuinely brings you joy and aligns with your
belly.
Values?
My
or are
belly
you buying
receives
it
joy when I buy those cheats codes.
Who aren't even paying attention to you.
Tonight.
That's the core of the identity audit, the performance of wealth versus the reality of it.
And that distinction is crucial because the performance is incredibly expensive.
It is. The sources drop a staggering
statistic. I may not be a smart man.
86%
I know what food is.
Are not millionaires.
That is insane. They are just financing a look.
To combat that specific signaling impulse, you introduce structural friction into your life.
That is the 72-hour firewall you mentioned earlier.
72-hour
firewall. Okay, so that doesn't apply to the Tuesday night burrito you were worried about, does it?
No,
because you're
no,
not going to eat
it
a burrito 3 days later.
It applies to any non-essential purchase over $50. You literally force yourself to wait 3 days.
That's the structural part you mentioned.
I'm not going to eat that burrito for 3 days. I'm going to let it sit there on the counter for 3 days.
Retailers purposefully manufacture urgency to hijack your dopamine system. But impulse desire has a biological half-life.
So you just wait it out. Saying.
By Friday, the item you desperately wanted on Tuesday usually feels completely optional.
That's the beauty of building systems instead of relying on willpower.
And that leads into the other structural fix that helps you kill the little leaks, which is the subscription purge.
Right. Oh, and this isn't just casually reviewing your bank statement, which most people skip anyway.
Correct. It is the nuclear protocol of canceling every single subscription you have all at once.
Just wipe the slate clean.
Exactly. Then you only re-add the ones you actively miss over the following weeks.
You are effectively using human laziness, you know, our natural behavioral inertia, to your advantage.
Instead of letting corporations use it against you, which is brilliant.
Because the invisible spending we were talking about here doesn't just drain your checking account in the present moment.
It eventually traps you entirely, especially as you hit your 40s, which historically should be your peak earning years.
So if your 30s are about surviving lifestyle creep, the 40s must be where the real structural damage happens.
Yes, absolutely. Your expenses naturally scale up.
The sources introduce us to a profile named Dave. Now, Dave is 43 years old, makes a very solid salary of $95,000 a year.
But he only has $87,000 saved in his retirement accounts.
He is just floating along, assuming he is doing okay because he can pay his bills.
But mathematically, he is in the danger zone. Fidelity's benchmark states you should have 3 times your annual salary saved by age 40.
3 times, okay.
Yeah, so based on his income, Dave should have roughly $285,000 invested.
He is dangerously behind the compounding curve.
And the 40s are the exact decade where people fall into the college versus retirement trap.
And the data on this is bleak. 62% of parents plan to actively delay their own retirement to pay for their children's college tuition.
Which, you know, sounds incredibly noble.
Right, you want to help your kids.
Of course. But the ironclad rule the sources emphasize is that retirement must always come first.
The reasoning is purely structural.
There are no financial products called retirement loans.
Oh, wow, yeah.
Your kids can access financial aid or scholarships or student loans to fund their education.
But absolutely no bank is going to finance your living expenses when you are 75.
So what does this all mean? This is heavier than the oxygen mask analogy.
It is more like structural load bearing in architecture.
How so?
Well, if you remove the steel support pillars from your own financial foundation to build a fancy extension for your kid,
the whole house eventually collapses.
And then your child is forced to house and support you at 74 anyway.
Exactly. And the math penalizes delay very aggressively in your 40s.
Every single year you delay taking investment action during this decade, costs you between $60,000 and $66,000 in lost future wealth.
For every one.
Now, I'm just going to jump in here. Where are you at, and where you are in life makes a difference. But now this is the thing. Maybe you're in your 60s. Maybe you're in your 70s. Maybe you're in your 50s. They're talking about people right now in their 40s. The effect of how they're choosing to live is affecting their 40s. Now, 40s and 50s, typically people are in the latter stages of their children, starting into adulthood. And this is, it's the expensive years. You thought it was expensive having a baby. It's expensive, the whole college thing, the whole, starting a career, whatever they're doing, all the things that they're involved in through high school, costs of all that stuff. Every time you turn around, well, soccer shoes, got to play football, whatever it is. Got to buy uniforms, buy new books, whatever it is. Field trip, whatever. All those things just, let alone the food that some of these kids eat, just ridiculous mass quantities of food. They have, it's just expensive. Insurance, all that stuff's expensive. Let alone all the running around you got to do, carting them around everywhere, here and there. So it's all well and good. I mean, it's all worth it. Don't get me wrong. It's the issue is time can get away from you, and you think you have to spend, you're just throwing money at everything, and you're not. Literally looking at the possibility of what's it going to be like now when you get into your 60s and 70s, and all of a sudden you realize, I don't have anything saved. So it's a bad place to be. It's a difficult place to be. Let's put it that way. It's not undoable. The amazing thing to me is most people don't realize this. Your latter part of your 50s, your upper 50s through your 60s, typically for most people, and most generally, is your highest earning years of your entire life. Kind of amazing to me. Now some people bloom early. I know people in their 20s who never experienced their salad days. They literally were making money. Maybe they were working construction or whatever they were doing. They were always making good money right out of high school, or maybe right out of college. But most people who start into the trades right out of high school start making good money. They start making some pretty decent money for people their age. And to some degree, it can almost be detrimental because you don't really learn. You just think the money's going to be there, which is in some ways it develops a certain amount of confidence in a person as well. It's kind of a strange balance depending on the character of the individual, but it's a very delicate balance between having kind of a cocky attitude towards money, where you just. Think you can just always go out and earn it. And it may be a very strenuous physical labor style of earning money. And you realize when you get into your 30s or maybe when you have kids, now you don't have any energy left. You've got injuries. You've got all kinds of other things to deal with. Your shoulders are worn out or whatever it is. Or you got a bad knee. You got a bad foot. You got a bad whatever. Your back. So heaven forbid your back should have an issue. Now all of a sudden you can't crawl up on that roof. You can't do roofing. You can't do construction. You can't do the plumbing things that you were doing. You can't get down on your knees and do carpet, whatever it is. And that trade that you were doing or that business that you started. Most people who start a business out in their 20s and their 30s, typically what ends up happening is they end up working themselves into a more of a management position. They have workers doing the work for them. They expand, they scale up, and they end up not having to do the physical labor anymore. They hire young kids to do that stuff for them. Typically, if you have a successful business, that's what typically will happen. Sometimes there's people in their 40s still turning the wrenches, still doing the stuff, still running the sausage grinder. It is a difficult situation for some. And that's where I think it gets difficult in terms of It's the whole fist count. I don't know how long this thing doesn't give me an idea how much longer it's going to go. I don't know. I'll just keep playing it here for a little while and see how much further it goes. But
$1,000 a month you are investing, that is a steep penalty.
And you are also likely entering the golden handcuffs phase.
Right. The sources categorize this as net worth level 6, which is having a net worth between $250,000 and $500,000.
Yes. At this specific level, you are making good money.
But both incomes in a dual earning household are usually fully deployed just to sustain the mortgage and the established lifestyle.
So you look wealthy.
You look stable on paper, but you are structurally trapped.
Neither partner can afford to quit a toxic job.
Or take an entrepreneurial risk, or the whole financial architecture wobbles.
You become completely handcuffed to your current salary. Man.
There is another massive structural trap in your 40s that blew my mind, actually. The estate planning gap.
Specifically, the assets that completely bypass your will.
Oh, yes. This is a crucial mechanical detail regarding contract law that most people miss entirely.
What happens?
Well, your retirement accounts, like your 401ks and your IRAs, they bypass your will.
They go straight to whoever is listed on the beneficiary designation form.
Are you serious?
Yeah. Because a 401k is a legally binding contract with a financial institution, it supersedes probate court.
You could meticulously update your will after a divorce, but if you leave your ex-spouse on your 401k beneficiary form,
they get the money the moment you die. Wow, so your will is legally irrelevant to those specific accounts.
Completely irrelevant. So to loop back to your question about discipline,
we need systems that automatically protect us from those structural errors.
It is about building architecture.
Okay, so if we could manage to navigate those middle-class traps, and patch the software bloat of our spending and set up our firewalls.
How does actual wealth get built? And why does the process feel so impossibly, agonizingly slow in the beginning?
It feels slow because of a cognitive blind spot called exponential growth bias.
Human brains are just wired to process linear progression. We do not naturally comprehend compounding math.
Right. Our brains just aren't built for it.
Exactly. The sources break down the reality of a standard 40-year investing portfolio.
62% of all your compounding gains will happen in the very last decade of that 40-year window.
So all the magic is at the end.
Yeah, the first 10 years, they generate a mere 3.6% of your total lifetime gains.
Just 3.6% in an entire decade? I mean, here's where it gets really interesting, though.
It reminds me of the classic lily pad riddle mentioned in the sources.
Oh, right, the riddle.
Yeah, so if a lily pad doubles in size every single day and covers an entire lake in 48 days.
On what day is the lake half covered? Most people instinctively guess day 24.
Which makes sense linearly, but the actual answer is day 47.
Exactly. The lake is basically empty for a month and a half, and then boom, in 2 days, the entire surface is covered.
Your investment account is that lily pad. But surviving those first 40 days when the lake looks empty is the hardest part.
It really is. And to get to day 47, the sources lay out the 7-5-3-1 rule.
This rule basically serves as the architectural blueprint for outlasting the painfully slow phase of wealth building.
Okay, let's break down the mechanics of that. What is the 7?
The 7 stands for 7 years. That is the minimum time horizon you must commit to before judging the success of your portfolio.
It aligns with the rule of 72, which is a mathematical principle showing that at average historical market returns,
it takes about 7 years for your money to double once. So you just need to see it work.
Yeah, you need to experience that first double to prove to your brain that the underlying math actually works.
That makes noble sense. And the 5 stands for 5 asset types, representing diversification.
It ensures you have defensive assets built into your portfolio.
Right. Because when the stock market inevitably crashes, those defensive buffers ensure you don't lose everything in panic.
Exactly. Which leads directly into the 3. The 3 emotional phases every single investor must survive. Doubt, frustration, and panic.
I could definitely relate to those.
We all can. Doubt happens early on when your gains are tiny and you wonder if it is even worth it.
This is good stuff. I think I could listen to this for a long time. I got the mute button on there when I started talking initially, but, it's very interesting. I mean, I put 6 videos in there. Basically, it's giving us a synopsis, and I've heard most of these videos myself. So hearing them say some of the stuff, like the lily pad thing, it's dead on accurate of how the depiction of how he depicts it in the video. It's fascinating to me. Most people do think that if you say you get the whole lily pad thing, that's the way compound interest explodes. There's a point where your dividends, the money that your account, your savings account is making, your market account or whatever you got going on, the amount that it's making per year, it out outdoes what you're actually putting into it, it's at that point that the thing starts to snowball. Because now you're not only making, you know, the interest money that's coming in. And one of the things that we've got a really awesome financial guy that I would love to have him on the show and interview him sometime on a Friday. But he kind of has some rules around his the foundation that he works for, the company he works for. It makes it a little bit difficult because he's considered a spokesperson. Now, maybe he could come on. I'm not sure he can come on incognito not have any kind of affiliation with anybody, just kind of be an alias type thing. I don't want to ask him about that. I wonder if he can do that, if he'd feel comfortable doing that. It's a touchy situation because he is a financial counselor, and so he's got to be very careful with that kind of thing. But it'd be good to have him on, ask him, just pick his brain, ask him some questions. But this is the kind of thing, again, that this is Notebook LM. It's a part of, it's got a connection or association or affiliation with Google in that it works with Gemini. It's very closely related to your Google account or whatever it is. But it only draws from information that you put in it. It won't make anything up. It will literally just draw from those kinds of things. I use it for study a lot. I'll put in a bunch of documents that I need to study for my job. And it'll provide flashcards. It'll provide tests. It will provide video or a little slide deck type demonstration of something. If I ask it a question about something, it'll provide a slide deck to explain something. It'll do an explainer video. It'll do three different kinds of videos. One of them is an immersive video that kind of talks about the whole thing, which has some cartoon graphics kind of thing, like a whiteboard type thing. And there's another one. This is the interactive podcast, which is very, I think it's fascinating. And you can ask it questions. I think I'm supposed to hold the button down when I ask a question. I'm not sure exactly how it goes. You can't type in a question, though. That's kind of what's weird about it. I don't think. Maybe you can. It doesn't seem like there's a place where you can just type in a question, which would be nice if you could just type a whole thing in. They could ask it that way. But it's fascinating technology. I just kind of wanted to bring it up. So that's kind of what we have going on. But so that concludes this section of the News According to Me. There's more. Don't worry. We're coming back.
It's the news.
It's the news.
According to me, oh, it's the news.
It's the news.
According to me, it's the news.
It's the news.
According to me, oh, it's the news.
It's the news.
According to me, it's the news.
It's the news.
Yeah. According to me. According to me.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Now, that's all we got for today. It's been an interesting week. I got a kind of a stressful weekend ahead of me. It's stressful. It's a busy weekend. It's a intense weekend ahead of me. Leaving today for Dallas, but Shabbat Shalom, folks. Hope you have a great weekend. We're going to be working on some things for next week, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and then Thursday. Thursday there'll be a show. See how that all goes. And I'll be out of pocket for Friday's show. I'm just not going to be around for next Friday. This is the kind of stuff we want to kind of do a little bit more of. In the meantime, call the show, 574-651-7685, if you got any questions or comments. I will see ya. God bless.